For some of us, this is maybe a familiar story. And maybe if it's not familiar to you, at least maybe you've heard allusions to it, because in our English language, we have phrases that come from it: being blinded by the light, or scales falling from our eyes. People will talk about having a Damascus Road experience as a metaphor for something. And so a Damascus Road experience is a sudden turnaround, a conversion, a changing of your mind. It signifies some important event where things are never the same afterward. In religious experience, some Christians may ask you the question whether you've had a Damascus Road conversion, or maybe they might even ask you the specific time and date of your Damascus Road experience, by which they're asking you the time and place of when you were born again. But I think if this is the only thing we take from this story, if we think the story is only or primarily about Saul, we actually miss most of the story. This is one of those stories that many of us think we know well, but in fact, we may know less than we think we do. And so we need to pay attention about this story, maybe a little harder because we think it's familiar, because really it's not a story about one conversion. It's a story about two conversions. And the primary character may not be who we think it is. Like the original hearers, we come to this story from a point of hindsight. We, like the original audience, already know that Saul will become Paul, one of the greatest evangelists of all of the Christian faith. Paul will be responsible for spreading the gospel to different lands, and he is one of the most prolific authors of all of the letters in the New Testament. The story starts with a dramatic flair and a heightened sense of urgency and danger. It talks about Saul breathing threats of murder against the disciples of Jesus. I'm not quite sure what has provoked such wrath or why he's persecuting disciples with such vigor. The first time we saw him was at the stoning of Stephen when he was responsible for holding the coats. So maybe he got excited by that and wanted in on the action. We just don't know. But what we know is he's been given authority sent from Jerusalem, from the high priest, to gain entry into synagogues in Damascus to root out women and men of the way, which is what disciples of Jesus were known as, and then bring them back to Jerusalem for punishment, perhaps even death. And if Saul is only half as good at that task as he is at helping spread the gospel later on after his conversion, I can imagine he's very good at his job at rooting out and persecuting those that follow Jesus. Saul is not a man to be trifled with. So while on the road to Damascus with his official papers in hand, suddenly Saul is blinded by a great light and hears these words, "Why do you persecute me?" And did you notice that Jesus' question isn't, "Why do you persecute my followers?" or "Why are you persecuting my church?" But it's, "Why are you persecuting me?" As if to say explicitly, to persecute the followers of Jesus, to persecute the church, is the same thing as persecuting Jesus himself. Saul's response to that experience is, "Who are you, Lord?" Four words seeking meaning, four words seeking understanding for what's occurring, four simple words grasping for comprehension of experience of meeting Jesus face to face, four words of wonder and bewilderment, four words that don't comprehend what's going on. One line, that's it. That's all he gets in this drama is one line. So maybe Saul isn't the lead in this story after all. The story has become for some a model of what Christian conversion looks like, the model of what happens when you have a true religious experience with the living Christ, a flash of light, a sudden experience, a change of heart or direction, when you meet Jesus face to face, and then your life is changed forever. A highly personal moment between you and Jesus. This is what some in our faith consider to be the mark of a true Christian. When did you have your Damascus Road experience? When were you born again? We're told that Saul is blinded and his companions take him to a home in Damascus where he sits for 3 days, unable to see and unable to drink. Maybe it's not a sudden conversion after all. Saul sits for 3 days, so struck by what has happened that he can neither eat nor drink, let alone see. What could this mean, he might be wondering. In his pitiful state, he is now dependent on others for his care. This one with the official papers now has to trust someone else and has time to ponder his questions. So we get a new character entering into our drama, Ananias, a disciple of Jesus, a person of the way, one whom Saul would have sought out for persecution. Here's Ananias. Another character with another vision, another experience with Jesus. The Lord comes to Ananias, and his response, four little words, is a response that many of us, again, might be familiar with. Here I am, Lord. It's what we've come to know as a faithful response. We've heard that response from Isaiah and Samuel the prophets. God calls his name, and Ananias knows whose voice it is, recognizes the one who calls him. Here I am, Lord. Ananias is a faithful servant, a sheep of God's fold, recognizes the voice of his shepherd, willing to go wherever he's told, willing to do whatever it is that God asks. Ananias is a person of deep faith. And he's asked by God to do something incredible. Go see this man named Saul, who's in the city. Heal him, lay your hands upon him, and restore his sight. I'm sorry, who? You see, Ananias knows who Saul is. He knows Saul's on his way to town with orders to track down people of his kind and to bring them back to Jerusalem. Saul is that person that can capture Ananias and throw him in jail or worse. It's as if God were to come to Martin Luther King Jr. and tell him to go to the house of the Grand Wizard of the KKK. Or as we talked about in Sunday school this morning, imagine one of us being told when he was alive, go see Fred Phelps from Westboro Baptist Church. Yeah, he's going to be the one to bring good news to all the people. So Ananias, after saying, here I am, Lord, after issuing that faithful response, says, wait a minute. That's right, maybe not. But God says, Ananias, Saul is my chosen instrument to bring good news to the Gentiles and to kings and to all people of Israel. This person who's the chief persecutor of the followers of Jesus is now to become an instrument in spreading the good news to everyone. And Ananias goes. At great personal risk, he trusts God, and he goes. And I struggle with this part of the story. I'm not sure that I'm as faithful as Ananias. I have told you before that I no longer have any room in my theology, in my understanding, for our brothers and sisters of the faith who say, hate the sin but love the sinner. I don't really have room for people who see human beings as animals or who would put children in cages and separate them from their mothers and fathers. I don't know what to do with this story. But Ananias goes. And then he says, "Brother Saul," and puts his hand on this man who days before would have bound him and taken him away from everything he knew. He says, "Brother," and lays his hand on this person who has done evil things, this person who he's terrified of. I'm not sure that I could call someone brother. But what follows is even more miraculous. Saul regains his strength. He's baptized as a believer in Jesus. And then after spending time with the disciples, he begins to preach the good news of Jesus in the synagogues in Damascus. Those same synagogues for which he carries official papers from the high priest to ferret out people of the way. So maybe there are two conversions in this drama. There is Saul and there's Ananias. And by the extension, the community of disciples that Ananias brings Saul into. There is no conversion of Saul without Ananias. And there's no conversion of Ananias without Saul. I really don't want to like this story. It's hard. And as I said before, many Christians experience this story or talk about this sudden conversion as the only way. But they only talk about Saul's conversion. They don't talk about Ananias' conversion. And so if this is a true marker of Christian conversion, and we only talk about Saul, we're only missing part of the story. Certainly, they both had an experience of the risen Christ. Certainly, it's a personal event. Not only is it personal, but others witness the event. Those traveling with Saul, those in the synagogue. Saul doesn't have a full appreciation of what the event means until Ananias greets him as brother. So it's a commissioning and a call for both Paul, Saul, and Ananias. Certainly, our experiences with Jesus can be personal, but they are never private because they're experienced in and through the community of faith. Let me just say this. If you've not had a Damascus Road experience, if you cannot point to the moment when you decided to give your life to Christ, take a breath. It's okay. Some of us have had that experience. Many of us have not. Many of us might be like Ananias, who've been nurtured in the faith and have known the voice of God since the waters of baptism were sprinkled over us. So it's okay. I've heard someone call this conversion envy. Conversion envy when we don't have that same Damascus Road experience. They're concerned maybe that they haven't had such a dramatic experience, and it means they're not truly Christian, and it's just not true. I think so many more of us, at least from getting to know you and talk to some of you, have been cradled in the faith and nurtured in the faith, and you've always known God. You didn't need a big flash of light or a turnaround. Again, as someone said in Sunday school this morning, and I'm going to paraphrase this, maybe the bigger jerk you are, the more of a conversion experience you need. And so whether it's a Damascus Road experience or a long, faithful road, it doesn't matter. Maybe this story should be renamed to the conversion of two men. Saul needs a blinding light, Ananias does not, but both are changed in the story. And that main character that I have referred to, I already gave it to you weeks ago. It's actually the Holy Spirit. It's God at work. The primary actor in this story is God. It's God that initiates the conversion in both men. It's God that gives the commission, the vocation. It's God that has a mission. And Saul and Ananias are the instruments of that mission. Just as it is for us in our baptism, God is the author of our stories. God's the giver of our gifts and our calling. God meets us where we are and provides for us the experiences that we need. God meets us where we are, but doesn't leave us where we are. And again, that's also something that's kind of scary to me. But perhaps that's the more important element of this story, not how a conversion happens, but that it happens. God meets us where we need to be met, but doesn't leave us there. Instead, God pushes the boundaries and opens our eyes to even greater possibility, stretches us into places that we couldn't have imagined and with people that we couldn't possibly imagine. Like the early disciples, we are people of the way. Or maybe we should be called people on the way. People on a journey called and commissioned by God, changed by God in a very personal but never private way. A people in community. A people met by God but never left in the same place, but rather a people pushed even further. So don't be surprised if you hear a voice or see a light, because I know this, God's at work. God is stretching us, as uncomfortable as that might be sometimes, stretching us into lives of holiness, into paths of courageous witness, and hearts and voices full of praise. Amen.